Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Las Musas podcast and this edition of Ask a Musa. I am Monica Brown, and I'm the author of Charuco, El Arqueólogo Peruano, The Peruvian Archaeologist, Julio C. Tello, and the Lola Levine series, among others. And I am super excited to be with Angela Velez and Davila Cardinal and Jasmine Mendez. And it'd be great if all of you introduced yourself before we jump into conversation and answer these really interesting questions. So want to go ahead and start, Angela?
Sure. So my name is Angela Velez, or Angela Velez, and I'm the author of the YA novel Lulu and Milagro Search for Clarity, which comes out in 2022. And it's about two very different sisters who are on a high school field trip to visit college campuses across the country. And on the trip, they end up uncovering all these family secrets and kind of redefining their place in the world and imagining these bigger futures for themselves. And also there's like kissing and breaking curfew and that stuff. So
that sounds so awesome. And I should note, you get to ask Musas at very different places in their career. And Angela is our debut author. And we also have Anne. You want to introduce yourself? Davila Cardinal? Sure.
I'm Anne Davila Cardinal, and I'm the author of, Five Midnights and Category 5. The most recent is Category 5. It's it follows the same characters, and it takes place on the island of Vieques off of the coast, the northeastern coast of Puerto Rico. And it's about three teenagers sort of fighting evils, supernatural, human, and colonial. So it's horror. So it has lots of hearts being removed and things, but it's really a lot of fun. And it was nice to focus on the summer after Maria. So it's about the island dealing with the aftermath of the hurricane.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Anne. How about you, Jasmine?
Hi, yes, I'm Jasmine Mendez, and I am the author of Island of Dreams, which is a YA memoir, a multi-genre poetry prose collection, and as well as a debut picture book that is coming out in the fall of 2021, Josefina's Habichuelas, which is about a young girl who gives up sweets for Lent and then learns the family tradition of making habichuelas con dulce, which is a Dominican dish. And she learns that sometimes the sweetest things in life aren't sweets. And she learns how to carry on her family's tradition of making habichuelas con dulce on Easter. And so I'm excited about that coming out in the fall. I also have a second YA memoir coming out called A Bucket of Dirty Water, Memories of My Girlhood, which looks at my my childhood experiences from about 10 to 14.
Wow, all those books sound amazing. I can't wait. But we are here to talk and answer some questions. So I'm just gonna throw this out and we'll just have a conversation. The first question.
How did you start taking your writing seriously? And how do you make time for it in a busy life?
I began taking my writing seriously. At a certain point, I realized that though it was incredibly important to me and probably only second only to my family, it always came last. And that wasn't gonna work for me anymore. So after I finished my MFA, I made it a priority. And now my son has grown and I still work full time, but I make it, it's in the forefront for the first time. It was well overdue. And in terms of making time, I actually realized I write best in between life, when I'm home. Well, I've been home for over a year now. So I write at lunchtime, I write after work, I think about my work in progress when I'm walking. I just bring it into my life the best way possible. And I'm gonna have to do this for a while with a day job. So I figure I'm getting much better at it.
Cool. Angela, do you wanna?
Yeah, I would say for me, I started taking it seriously when I actually showed other people my writing, and that took a really, really, really long time. I think I ended up when I was working, taking a creative writing class and like actually having to workshop my work was when it felt like, oh, I have readers now. And so that was the moment where it was like, this could be a thing, I could get used to this. And I agree with Anne that 15 minutes here and there, when I had a full-time job, I would write during my lunch break. So I carry around a little notebook, or if I couldn't take a lunch break, I would, in my Outlook, block out 15 minutes, two or three periods in the day, where I could write as much as possible. And at the end of the week, it kind of starts adding up, and it feels nice on a Saturday when you're like typing your whole week's worth of writing, and it feels like you've actually done something. So that's, I'm a proponent of the 15 minute increments here and there.
Cool. Yeah.
So for me, I started taking it more seriously, probably like back in 2012, when I got really chronically ill and had to leave my full-time job, and was like at home. And I had always written poetry, and I'd sort of dabbled in it, and I did a lot of performance poetry and things like that. And had like one or two small pieces published in very small journals and things. But when I had to leave work, I was like at home, and I was like, well, I have time and I need to fill this time with something. And so that's when I put my first poetry prose book collection together within like 6 months of just being at home and just trying to recover from illness and staying up late at night because I was on a lot of prednisone and steroids. And so I was just had these sleepless nights. And so I just was like, well, let me get these 10 years worth of writing together into a book and see what happens. And then I did continue to try to work off and on. I ended up working from home full time for many years. And that's when I started developing a really stronger writing routine. And so I write in the morning. It used to be 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. I blocked those 2 hours, but now I have a child and my child wakes up at 7. So I tend to write 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. So I'm up really, really early. And that's the time that I get to myself to carve out for that writing time. I usually don't do well with anything past 3 p.m. So writing is definitely out of the question. But I do, as Anne was saying, I'm always thinking about my writing. So back in the pre-pandemic days, when I would drop my little girl off, you know, to daycare, I would think about things as I was driving her. Commute time was really a great time for me to kind of like just like it just gets the juices flowing. Like I'm just kind of, you know, especially if I'm going somewhere that I always go, then I can just kind of, I brainstorm a lot. Washing dishes, I get a lot of ideas. Cleaning the kitchen, sweeping in the morning. So I have sort of these rituals when I'm cleaning, and then ideas just kind of start flowing, or I'm always thinking about writing, or I'll write down things in my phone at a stoplight, you know, in my notes app. And so, you know, as Angela was saying, like, eventually it adds up, right? And some of those lines are really great. Some of them are like, what was I thinking? You know, but you get it done. But I do definitely like to dedicate those 2 hours in the morning to just like write and daydream and read and revise. Hasn't happened in a couple weeks because I've been taking a break from stuff, but overall that's what I have, and I'm a morning writing person. So
I love this creatively finding time to be creative. I just relate to what each of you are saying, and I think that I took writing seriously very early on because I had a mother who took art seriously. She was an artist, and so any dream I had about art or creativity was taken as seriously, I suppose, as some kids who said, I want to do this or this. So it wasn't seen as this impossible thing. It was encouraged. And I'm so grateful to that for that. And I know that I've raised my daughters the same way. And I know this because my oldest daughter, Isabella, named after my mom, Isabel, she finished Harry Potter. She was really young. I want to say like 7 or 8 or 9 at the oldest. And she was so devastated. She decided to keep writing it herself. And one day she came down and she said, Mom, because I was already a published author, I think you should show this to your agent. And it was her continuation of the Harry Potter series. And I said, oh, and I just said, you know, well, that's wonderful. I agree. It's fantastic writing, but usually, and I explained a little bit about copyright, but I love that she thought I can have a voice that can be as public as J.K. Rowling's when she was so young. And I'm also glad, Jasmine, you mentioned something I don't talk about a lot, but I have a chronic illness, and it was a very serious illness. And what I did when I was younger is I I had a full-time job as a teacher, which we all know takes a lot of creative energy. And I also had small children. I did have a super supportive partner, my husband, Jeff. But I want to say something, and that's that I sacrificed. I did. And what I sacrificed, that I guess this is a cautionary tale, was like sleep and taking care of my body. And I can't go back or look with regret, but I definitely have a different perspective now. And it's maybe less ambitious or maybe just less frenetic in the trying to do it all. And I really wish I could tell my younger self, like, take care of that body that's carrying your brain around, that's writing so much, instead of, or traveling, promotion, because as a young writer, like, I was just saying yes to everything. And it worked, it's good, but I know I didn't prioritize my physical health. And so that's what I would do differently if I could. So let's see the next question, question number two.
Hello, Musas. I would really like to know more about revisions. Can you walk us through your first draft to your final draft? How many revisions, maybe how much changes from the original first draft until you have that final wonderful story?
Angela, go ahead.
This was such a hard question because I love revising. I would revise forever. Even like now that I have like a strict revision schedule with my editor, like I could keep going. And I think when I first started writing the book, I had an outline. That outline got revised a lot because that was a way to kind of procrastinate writing the manuscript. And then once I started writing the chapters, so much of the later chapters have like influenced big changes in the first chapters. But in terms of like practical entire manuscript revisions, I probably on my own did 2 or 3, maybe. And then that's not counting individual chapter revisions. And then I did a big one for my agent, and I'm doing around 2 revisions for my editor right now. So that still feels fewer. Infinite, it feels like, for me at least. And that's someone just as a perma editor, I'm kind of always thinking, how can I make this better? How can this scene be bigger? Or what if this person was also at this in the scene, that kind of thing.
Sometimes at writing conferences, I show a screenshot of a file with how many, I show Marisol McDonald Doesn't Match, No Combina, because it's one of my most books that kids have really loved and has had lots of editions. And I say, look at how long and many years to get this published. It was super rejected by many people. And now it's one of my most beloved books in its I Don't Even Know edition. And I think that they're shocked at how much effort it takes to create these beautiful pieces of art and literature that work just together in a picture book. Anne, what about you? What's your revision process like?
Well, it's interesting. When Angela was talking, I realized that, you know, that I have an adult novel coming out next year called The Storyteller's Death. And that I revised for 16 years. I abandoned several times. I first person to third person, then back again. And I was just thinking that lately it's been three, usually 2 with my agent and then 3 with my editor, but the editor piece is 3. And I realized it's because I plot now. I used to say that, you know, oh, it would interfere with my creative, I was a pantser. And then I realized that I would write entire novels and have to go back and impart structure. And it's like making a body and putting in the bones last. And I would go off in tangents. I love tangents. And so now that I plot, it's much tighter. And I the first draft is lean. And I used to hate first drafts I used to hate revision because the first draft was fun. And I realized now that the first draft is you're making the materials with which you then make the art. And so now I just think they're a chore. So I just get the first draft down, so the story's down, and the second draft is now my favorite because that's when you're sculpting it into something. And that's where I find I'm walking around the house with a notebook and I'm thinking about it at nighttime. And that's when it really gets into my consciousness is that second draft.
Wow, that's amazing. You're here, as I listen, I think, these writers are so dedicated. And I think it's good because it dismisses the myth of the muse visits and it just flows out. I know for me, I have many, many books, probably approaching 25 or 30. And I can think of maybe two books that just flowed like that. And the rest were just blood, sweat, and tears. So,
yeah, you can't trust her. You can't trust that muse.
You have to be sitting at the computer when she visits. That's for sure. Jasmine, how about you? What's your revision process like?
Yeah, it's it really varies. I write in so many different genres that it really kind of depends on the genre in some ways. But you know, I think I'm not like. It's hard to say how many rounds of revisions I complete because I guess I'm constantly revising. And so I guess it depends on what you consider a revision. Like if you revise the whole book, is that one revision? Or like a chapter, is that revision 25, right? Like I go in and I'll tweak, you know, just a chapter or just a section or just a poem. And is that considered like a revision? Like, I don't know, right? So like, if you really think about it, I'm constantly, you know, sort of going in and revising up until I feel like, okay, I've done enough. And if I continue to do this, it's going to be something that I won't even recognize. So let me just stop and send it to whomever it needs to get sent to. It really just depends on the genre because, you know, like a playwriting process for me right now, it looks entirely different than a book, right? Like I have to have readings of the play in order to know what it sounds like in order to revise it. And so one of the plays that I'm working on right now is going into its third developmental process of having a reading done of it. And so maybe this is like the third version of the play, but I know that I've done things in between as well, right? And, you know, some things, like Monica was saying, flow out of me. This middle grade book that I was recently working on was literally the first and only thing that's ever just flown out of me in like a 3-month span. And mind you, this is the first foray into fiction really that I've done, aside from my picture book, which is a more compressed version of fiction, if you will. This is the first sort of like full length book, completely fictional characters, completely fictional story that I've ever worked on in my entire life. And it was just like, spilled out of me, and which is like never happens, but still went through a meticulous amount of revisions before I sent it to my agent, because again, like I love revising. I believe the real art and the real writing happens in revision, and at first, like getting to my computer to revise, I'm like, it's like it's so painful because I'm afraid that I'm just gonna hate everything I recently wrote and I'm just dreading like rereading those words. But then once I start, like I could get sucked in for hours. You know, if I have the hours in the day to just sit at the, you know, at my desk and do it, then I will easily get sucked in. But yeah, I love revision, and it just really depends on the project how many revisions it gets. But there are things that like in my published books that I will read now and I'll be like, can I change that?
Jasmine, I count four genres that you write in: nonfiction, fiction, and playwriting.
Yes,
and you write in too, Anne. Right? You write in fiction, adult fiction, YA.
Well, yeah, the age group thing. But I'm just people who write in all those genres really just amaze me. I just think that's a spectacular plethora of gifts.
I agree.
The poet fiction writer, I just feel like it's cheating. Yeah. It's just such a huge advantage. I'm so jealous.
Okay, to be fair, it's a novel in verse. to be very fair.
I love novels in verse. Oh.
I think picture books are poetry because you can define poetry as language distilled and you have 500 to 1,000 words, maybe if it's a school and library market. So I like to think of children's books as a type of poetry, and it's hard, more challenging for me to write the longer stuff. I write picture books and chapter books. And I will say with each of my chapter book series, the Sarai and the Lola Levine, it did start to flow around book 4 amazingly, but that's because you're living with those characters and you really don't leave the world for very long. But I'm the opposite of you, Anne. I think the first draft, getting a full draft, is so painful and challenging for me. And then I enjoy revising more, whereas Anne said that that's the fun part. So I hope folks listening know that there's not one like magic formula. You have to, it's trial and error. So this is a fun question that someone submitted. This is about antagonists.
Hi, everyone. This is Emma Otegi, and I have a question for my fellow Musas.
which is that I would love to hear more about how you are all approaching your antagonists. I find that lately, you know, my antagonist is often the person in the book who I know best after the main character. And especially with a child, I often feel, you know, a lot of sympathy for this character, but I know that kids aren't necessarily going to see that sympathy because they're kids and they just sort of see the antagonistic dimension. So I just was wondering if you all would be willing to talk a little more.
And so let's talk about not the hero, but the person causing the hero trouble, or if you even think in those terms.
This was also a really interesting question because I think like all characters kind of, they need their own needs and wants. And that's what makes characters kind of multi-dimensional. And an antagonist, their needs and wants are just in direct opposition to your characters for whatever reason. And so I don't know if I prioritize making them sympathetic. Like that's kind of up for the reader to decide, but I do want them to hopefully not be kind of like a cardboard bad guy or bad person and have a little bit of depth as to like why they're acting that way, even if that reason is not something you might agree with or whatever. But I also write lighter books, so that helps that the antagonists are not these really big, big, bad people. And in fact, sometimes your antagonist is your own character and they are like their biggest impediment, in which case I hope they're sympathetic. But again, that is kind of up for the reader to decide.
In my case, the antagonists are often not human, but and even when they're not human, the multi-dimensional is so necessary because otherwise they're cartoons. You use something else, Anela, the one-dimensional.
Cardboard,
like exactly. So you have to make them dimensional, and I end up getting attached to them. And I created a character for Five Midnights that I thought was gonna be a human antagonist, and she ended up being basically everyone's favorite character. And then in the second book, she's a hero. So I think, and I can't speak to writing for little children. Monica, I think you can speak more to that. Actually, all of you, because you write for younger kids too. But when I was young, I wanted antagonists to be purely evil, you know, the good and evil, because then you feel okay, like rooting against them. And then in middle school, I think I started to grasp the complexities of how people aren't just good or bad. You know, that's what it seems like to me. I write for teens and they want the complexity. So, but I do end up getting attached to them with time.
Definitely.
Yeah, for me, it's interesting since I'm just now kind of dabbling into writing sort of more like fiction and having books with, you know, sort of like this plot structure and this like narrative arc and this character arc. It's been an interesting journey so far. I can only really speak to my works in progress, if you will, like the middle grade novel in verse and this other YA book that I'm currently working on. So I don't know how it'll be received, but what I've noticed, even in sort of like my memoir book, is usually the antagonists are not other people. It's like the society at large. So the antagonist is racism or chronic illness or, right, sort of these other structures that are imposed upon the main character, with occasional like characters that kind of either feed off of that, right, and can also be seen as antagonists, but they are complex, right? I had a great mentor in my MFA program who used to say, especially for creative nonfiction memoir writing, that the people that you write about and they create, that they're neither villain nor victim, same as the main character is neither villain nor victim, so that they are truly complex individuals. And so same thing with whatever antagonist or with whatever people or things that are imposed upon the main character that the main character is struggling with or has tension with, that it's neither, right, villain nor victim. So even my main character in the middle grade novel, who she's living with a chronic illness, that you can see is that being the antagonist, right? But there are moments of reprieve and what she learns from living with a chronic illness, right? So even the illness isn't necessarily all bad, right? So she's able to gain some perspective just on her life as like this young girl living with this illness. And she's able to see things differently now and empathize with different people in her life. Same as like her mom isn't necessarily a villain or a victim, though we see her mom kind of as being the antagonist towards like, you know, she wants to do this thing and her mom is like, no, you can't do this thing that you want to do. But then you realize like there's a root to this, right, to why her mom says she can't do the thing. Like her mom carries her own demons. And you see that in the book, right? Her mom is not necessarily all bad. She's doing this out of like a mother's love and protection. And so I think it's important to see that because as you're getting older, right, as you're a middle grade student or like a young teen, that's when you do start to see the people around you as more fully human in some ways, or start to see that there are complexities. And I definitely think it's important to like pay attention to that and to show that in the characters that we create.
That's excellent. I think about this because obviously there needs to be tension in books and, you know, overcoming challenges and conflict is how humans grow. And so I've explored this with, especially in my chapter book series, the Sarai series and the Lola Levine series. And I guess I'll share a fun anecdote. Some of it, of course, is my experiential knowledge as the mother of children and as my growing up myself. But I'll tell you a fun anecdote for the Lola series, because I know I'm still very sensitive to being excluded. And so I've really drawn some memories when I was young, but I also took one of my oldest friend's daughters, who was a fourth grader, out to brunch. And she shared things that were really creative new ways of excluding. And one anecdote she shared that ended up in the book is that, you know, when girls have slumber parties over the weekend and they would come to school and all have matching fingernails. And so that's how you'd know that they all got together without you. And they do things like that. And that like hurt her, you know, because exclusion hurts. And so I ended up using things like that in the book out of conversations with young people. And when I give workshops, I always say, you don't have to have children to write for children, but you have to understand how they think, how they talk, what their challenges are. And of course they're multidimensional. All children are, all humans are actually, but, and I think especially young people deserve to have, to not be cutouts in literature and to be complex and capable of growth. But that doesn't mean we're all gonna get along or have similar attitudes towards kindness or social justice or racial justice. Okay, this is a complex question, and I've heard a lot of debates about it, and it has to do, and I think we'll probably have representation here from people who have MFAs and people who don't. So the question is...
Hello, I would like to hear from the Musas about continuing education to MFA or DIY. What are your opinions on getting an MFA, the pros and cons versus doing it on your own? And if someone is looking for other types of continuing education opportunities that tie into children's literature, what would you recommend? The only example I can really think of is library sciences. Thank you so much for your advice.
And I'm going to open it up, but I will say there are a lot of free resources from Las Musas, for example, out there that are amazing. But who wants to jump into the DIY or MFA question?
Full disclosure, I'm biased. So it is my day job to recruit applicants for the MFA in Writing for Children and Young Adults at Vermont College of Fine Arts. But I can say that I'm also an alum. I can say that in particularly low residency is very appealing because if you most of us can't pick up our lives and live in a writer's bubble for 2 years on a campus. And so you have to integrate your study into your life. And that was really good for me because I got into these habits of doing the MFA that I now use in my writing career in terms of fitting it in. And also the community is invaluable. You know, I would go to residencies or workshops and I'd be all excited for 2 weeks. And then you lose touch with people and then it wears off. When you have 2 years, you cement it. You know, you cement these relationships in this community, and also you build your craft muscles. And that's for me, you know, that was the foundation when I was in it, was building my muscles for craft. And then afterward was community, because there is no way I'd have a writing career without my BCFA community. No way. And so, and if you don't have the resources to do that, I would say, I mean, SCBWI isn't very expensive to join, and it is an incredibly good resource for workshops. Highlights has great opportunities in the HIP scholarships. I would just say, just keep active and working and getting feedback on your work, whether it's from peers or mentors. So
I'll jump in too and say, so I earned my MFA in, God, what year is this? I earned my MFA in 2019, I believe. Yeah. The summer of 2019. And it was my third degree. I have a BA in English literature and MED, both from U of H. And it took me a long time to decide to want to get an MFA. It wasn't even on my radar until I started to take my writing seriously after my first book came out. And I wanted, I really didn't have a writing community necessarily, and I wanted to get feedback on my writing. So I will say, first and foremost, decide what it is that you want, either out of your writing or out of an MFA. I knew that my goal with an MFA was not to teach in academia. I have no interest in teaching at the academia and the college level. I'll teach workshops here and there, you know, if college professors call on me or et cetera. But that wasn't the goal. My goal was I wanted one-on-one mentoring. I wanted to build a community of writers. I wanted to get feedback on my work. I felt like I was writing into sort of this void. And so I was willing to make the commitment, and I was willing to put in the money, all of which I paid for out of pocket. Mine was a low residency MFA. I went to Pacific Lutheran University Rainier Writers Workshop, which I highly recommend, because it wasn't necessarily sort of one model. Like the folks getting their MFA at PLU come from a wide range of backgrounds. A lot of folks are older. Most of folks are older. Most folks have families and lives and full-time jobs and all of that. And so it really felt like a warm, welcoming community. And I did it for me. Like I always say, my first two degrees are for my parents. My MFA was for me. And I knew that it wasn't necessarily like, oh, I want to advance my career. It was like, I want to improve my writing skills. I want to get feedback. I want to build a community. So for that, it has been phenomenal. It was an amazing choice for me. But in the meantime, I also spent a lot of time engaging in other outside communities. I attended VONA, Voices of Our Nation Writing Workshop, in which was the most amazing week of my life for writing. I was under Willy Perdomo, an amazing Afro-Latinx poet. And have another community of friends there. We still have a group chat and we're constantly in communication. Also attended Canto Mundo, which is another poetry writing community. I went to one session. I was supposed to go last year, but then the pandemic happened. And so I've built in community through Canto Mundo, now a part of Las Musas. So I definitely encourage and highly suggest that MFA isn't for you and it's not for everybody, and not everybody has the financial resources to do that. There are so many writing communities out there, especially for BIPOC writers now that are coming up, that will hold and support you. I've learned the most just from my community of writers. Yes, my mentors were great. Don't get me wrong. They were all amazing and I had wonderful workshop sessions. But what keeps me learning is the people around me, is the friends that I can call on. Just this week, I had two amazing phone calls with other poet writer friends. That I was like, hey, can you look at this poem? Hey, can you look at this mind map and tell me just what you see? And, you know, and your friends, like your writing community, will see things in your work that you don't see, or even in just an outline. Like if you say, hey, can you look at this outline for me and tell me, like, what is it that you see I'm trying to do here? Because I don't see it, right? And so they're able to give you feedback. And that's been the most rewarding and valuable thing, I think. I'm not necessarily like a part of too many organizations where there's like fees and things like that just yet. I'm not a part of SCWBI. I always forget like the acronym for that just yet. I probably should be. But again, a lot of those, a simple Google search will help you find so many free resources and webinars, especially now with the pandemic. So many things are available online. And so I highly encourage and recommend that. But really, community from the get-go for me has been like the most important. Even before my MFA, I was always a part of open mic nights and slam poetry scene. And that was my group. That was who I learned from. That's who kept me excited about writing and continued to push me to pursue, you know, the work itself. So find your people. It's so important.
Yeah, to second all of this. So I did go to a traditional MFA program, and I knew for me that decision was as much creative as it was financial. And I knew I couldn't take on any more student debt. And so I ended up attending a program that was fully funded. So I didn't pay tuition and I was given a stipend to teach an undergrad course each semester. And the stipend was small, but it was enough to live on in Pittsburgh. So I like that experience. I would say like the pros are that because it was funded, I was paid to write for 3 years. I discovered I love teaching. And I ended up doing some audio work. I spent a summer at NPR. Like I found other ways to kind of channel this creativity. My faculty chair was a Dominican writer, Angie Cruz, whose novel is amazing. Yeah, it's so good. And having her sit, like champion my work and say like, keep going, you can do it and review my pages, that was incredible. And also my thesis ended up becoming my debut novel. It wasn't finished when I graduated, but I finished it after, like in the year and a half after graduating. And so that was really incredible. The cons, I would say, on the other hand, are that it does require major sacrifices, obviously financial if it's not fully funded, but also like 3 years in a city that I didn't know anybody, a predominantly white city, teaching at a predominantly white institution, which honestly, it was really shocking. It was the smallest city I had ever lived in. And so that you have to factor that into like being creative and like starting a community over again. Could also say like there's no guarantees that professors and even your classmates will necessarily like understand your writing. So for me, I didn't go to my program right after college because I wasn't really confident in my writing. I needed time to really like envision the kind of voice that I wanted to have. And like, you will get whack feedback and you just kind of have to like roll with it and say like, I know what I want my work to be and just kind of go with it. So I would say like, if it makes financial sense and you're confident in your work, like that might be a good time to consider a program. But I really think I would have written this book without the program. It might've taken me a little bit longer and it probably even more revisions. It's hard to imagine that. But like, I'm grateful for the community I had. I'm grateful for the time I had, but I also like, you don't need an MFA program at all to be a writer, to get published at all. Yeah.
And can I just say too, I'll jump in to thinking about like the difference between like a fully funded or even just like a full-time MFA versus a low res. I will say that I knew, speaking to a little bit of maybe the tension that Angela felt in a like a full-time MFA, like I knew that there was no way that I wanted, needed, or could handle being in workshop 2 or 3 times a week with a group of people that were not going to understand, you know, like the whose feedback was just not going to serve me. So that's why for me, a low residency made sense because again, I was so far along, like I already had a book published. I was far along enough and confident enough in my work that I was like, no, I want one-on-one attention that I know a mentor is going to give me. I could handle 10 days of workshop, right, in the summertime. Like I could handle that little block, you know, but otherwise, like there was no way I was going to be able to sit and like, you know, a predominantly white MFA program, you know, 3 days a week or however many days a week for hours at a time, having people nitpick about my Spanish words or my references. Like, I was good. Like, I was like, I'm good with that, you know, right? And so really knowing yourself, right? If you know that you could benefit from not that experience, but like she knew, right? Or perhaps found out like that Angie Cruz, who's phenomenal, was in that program, right? So think about who are the teachers, who are the professors, if you are looking seriously into a program that you want to learn from. That's definitely like what I would highly suggest too. Like if you're trying to decide, if you are in the position where you can either go full-time or low res and you're trying to decide what you want to do, then think about like, who do I want to learn from and look at those programs, right? Obviously financial things are always going to be a question, right? But what really brought me to, because I looked at the Vermont College as well, but what really drew me to Rainier Writers Workshop was that I spent over an hour and a half with Rick Barrett on the phone, him just like listening to me and talking to me. So he like really made an effort, and he's the MFA program director over there, to get me excited. Like he really wanted to know, right, why I wanted to do that program. And he really listened to me. And he was a great champion of just my work and just of my time while I was there. So again, look at the professors, look at what you want out of a program. And I was also gonna just mention real quick, I teach for a lot of community programs as well. So look in your community, like in San Antonio, there's Gemini Inc. Who offer workshops. In Houston, there's Imprint. There's the Kenyan Writers Workshop. There's so many things both locally and nationally that offer sort of like, you know, 4-week workshops, 6 weeks workshops, where you're going to learn from amazing people, and it's going to be a fraction of the cost. And a lot of them offer scholarships. So just think about that.
Yeah, and actually, I'm going to be on the faculty of Qwelly, the Color of Children's Literature Conference, and there's a lot, and I'm doing just a half-day workshop on writing picture books, and they have lots of scholarships, too, and so I think I'm the only one then here who doesn't have an MFA. I am a literature professor, so I had a Cinderella story in that my first children's book that I ever wrote was published, but it's not really, because I've been teaching Latinx literature, studying it, reading it, and then creating it. And I worked as a professional writer in lots of ways. I guess the only thing I'll add is I agree with everything everyone says, but my caution is I would worry about going into debt for any graduate program in this moment, because no one goes into writing to begin with. So I think it's ideal if you can do low res and you have fun, you know, you're working or have a way to survive and have funding, or you get a scholarship. I guess some of the, and I have been in MFA writing workshops because I auditioned and they let me in at Ohio State while I was there to take some. But yes, especially if you're a writer of color, it can be very challenging and isolating at times. And in addition, if you write YA or children's, there are hierarchies in those types of programs. And I guess, you know, this isn't true of every program, but my concern sometimes is if like me, you're very community minded and wanting to create change with your work, is that it feels like sometimes there's a certain audience of other MFA students in MFA programs that don't go to community realities. And that's what I have found challenging. Like, why do we write, you know, and how esoteric or are the audiences really elite, you know, and that's certainly not why I write. And I do think there's so many amazing resources out there for writers, and there are ways to learn if you want to learn. And when I teach writing, my very first thing I suggest is to read intensely in your genre. To me, that's a fantastic training. And then, yes, go to either SCBWI, Qwelly, there's all sorts of conferences, and learn about the, you know, conventions of your field, because you do need to professionalize in that way. But if you have the resources and can spend 3 years writing, I don't think it's an either or. I just want to, from my perspective, say that you can learn, you can grow, you can professionalize outside of an MFA program. You know, it will probably give you more opportunities to teach, but the academic market is also so crazy right now. I guess I just want to protect people from debt, especially writers that are underrepresented or marginalized or don't come from certain privileged economic backgrounds.
And Monica, you actually brought something up that I think is very interesting. If the program isn't geared specifically towards writing for children and young adults, I think we've probably all encountered that bias where I was at AWP, somebody says, what do you write? And I say, well, I write horror for teens. And they're like, when are you gonna write a real book? And it's like, they don't understand that the craft concerns are the same. Plus we have the added responsibility of the audience we're writing for. And so we're fighting for recognition in the literary world at large. So try to find, you know, if you are going to do it, find a place that has a large representation for writing for children and young adults, because it's a hard, that's a tough.
Okay, I'm going to share some chisme then. I admit it, yes. But I'm going to. It's too good of a story. When I was at Ohio State, I learned from some great, they let me in to these MFA classes. And one of them was Lee K. Abbott, may he rest in peace. But I actually told him this to his face when I saw him at a book festival. So this isn't bad chisme. And he was a really good teacher, but in my first round of workshop story, I got all this amazing feedback. I was a little more experimental in my second piece. And he ripped me in class, which is sort of a ritual, you know, in some MFA programs. But this was his insult. He said, the start of this story, he read a passage. This reads like Joyce Carol Oates, but then you end up Beverly Cleary. And later when I saw him at the book festival, I said, I ended up like Beverly Cleary. So what was the biggest insult of my piece was that I was good. It sounded like it was something Beverly Cleary could write, like for young people, because it was a piece with teen protagonists. And now that still delights me. It's such a juicy anecdote because I went on to passionately write for children by choice.
Love it. Yeah. And I was just going to piggyback off of what you had said earlier, Monica, about the professionalization of it in the sense that, like, my MFA taught me nothing about, you know, getting an agent or publishing or query letters. Like, that has been all hands on deck, me and Google. Like, Google taught me that, you know, like, I've learned through that just by being sort of like, just like, I just jumped in and just had to figure it out. And through other people's, like other agents, like Eric Smith Rocks, his whole like page is very helpful. So many just people through Twitter. I have learned so much about like how the industry works through Twitter, because I did the work to figure that out. My MFA program, they don't talk about publishing. They don't talk about the industry. They don't talk about any of that. And so, you know, don't think you're going to get a, I mean, some of them have started to, but don't think you're going to sort of get a course on how to like market yourself or how to query an agent or how to do all these other things. Cause that's not what you're paying the MFA for. Like, all of that is just kind of baptism by fire.
Yeah. And even in my 3-year program, you'd think in the 3 years they'd fit in like how to get an agent or all that. And that's not there. It's like the focus is just really on prose, like even plot, like how do you get from the beginning of a book to the end was kind of like, figure it out and show us what you've got. And so like, I think like going into any kind of program, being very realistic about like, what is this program bringing? Also like, think about like, what are you going to end up contributing to the program? And like, are you going to kind of get sucked into like, creating this community and doing all this extra work that you aren't like really getting paid to do. Like I like somehow found myself on like grad student like council and making the lounge bet. And I was like, why am I doing this? Like that kind of stuff, like really know yourself as a person. And I will also second, like my program, there were no young adult lit. And in some ways that made getting feedback a little bit easier because I was like, okay, like, you just don't know. You don't know the field. Like, I'm not going to add in my contemporary YA novel, like a history of Peru, like in chapter 2, like that's just not going to happen. I'm not going to explain like things that are irrelevant to the story. And that kind of made for me things much easier to get through. But on certain days, or like just if you're not in the mood, like it can just be tough sometimes too at the same time. And it's 3 years. My program is 3 years. So that can be a lot.
These are all such amazing tips and insights. And again, we each bring individual perspectives. We're done with our questions, but I want to just before we go, these women that I'm getting to talk to on a Sunday morning are so interesting. I would love to know what your next book is going to be.
Yeah, I'll share because I talked just a little bit about it already. My middle grade novel in verse that just sent to my agent like 2 weeks ago, which is also like a weird thing for me because I got published without an agent before. And so saying that, I'm like, who am I? It's such a weird thing to come off of my mouth. But yeah, it's called Ani del Mar Jumps In. And it's about a young girl who gets diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis. And she loves to swim. And suddenly she finds herself unable to do the thing that she loves, not just because of chronic illness, but because her mom is deathly afraid of the water. And so you kind of go on this journey with her as she starts to learn to navigate her chronic illness as a young girl. and her friendships and her relationship with her mom and her dad. It's set in Galveston, Texas. And yeah, I wanted to bring in some Texas in there. And she's Dominican, her whole family's Dominican. And yeah, we just kind of go on this journey with her to find out how she navigates her new diagnosis and her mom, right? Being a 13-year-old girl with a mom who says no to the things that you want to do.
My next one is a YA horror rom-com that I can't talk about yet, but the adult magical, it's a Puerto Rican magical realist novel that takes place in the 70s in Bayamon in Puerto Rico. And it's the closest thing to a memoir I'm ever gonna write, and it's magical realist. So, but it's about a young girl who's when she turns 18 and the storytellers in her family die, she sees their stories as visions and they get progressively more difficult, and then she has one that actually she has to solve, or it's going to it might kill her. So it's that's the 16-year project. So I'm very excited that comes out from Source Books in 22. So
that sounds amazing.
Yeah, I'm working on my second book, which I think it's too soon. It's to really know where it's going. I have an idea, but it's still like I'm still in the early stages. But it will be set in Pittsburgh, which is not, I never imagined I'd write a story, but now that I've been here for so long and the pandemic like really stuck here, it's just is gonna be kind of a nice ode to this city that ends up being a lot more diverse once you kind of like peek under and end up in the nooks and crannies. So that's kind of what I'm hoping it'll be.
Sounds awesome.
What are you working on, Monica?
I like all writers, there's secret unannounced projects that you can't talk about, but I'm excited about the next two picture books coming out. One, because it's about two politicians that I admire so much, and shout out Texas too, the Castro brothers, Julian and Joaquin Castro, and it's called Small Room, Big Dreams. And Mirel Ortega is the illustrator, and Dr. Carmen Tafoya, a friend, was a consultant and also the translator. And here's a pro tip. If you can get a translator that's a poet, it's amazing. And she grew up and is close to the Castro family. So it feels so special. And I wanted the dignidad literaria y política that they bring. And I wrote it during the past administration. So it felt very good to focus on them. But the book I'm super excited about that's fiction, because I feel like I've been just writing nonfiction, is about my mom and my grandmother, so Isabel and Esther. And it's also magical realism, and it's about three generations of women and creativity, and it's called The Turquoise Room, El Cuarto Turquesa, and an amazing illustrator that I've wanted to work with so long, Adriana MJ Garcia, is doing it. And it's my most autobiographical, Marisol McDonald, Lola Levine, a lot of my books are semi-autobiographical, but this is an homage to my mother and grandmother. So I'm excited about that. Thank you all. This has been so fun. I'm gonna get off of this and go order books. It's kind of crazy. If you'd like to learn more about Las Musas or our books, please visit our website at lasmusasbooks.com or find us on social media at Las Musas Books. And be sure to check out our bookshop page, where each purchase of our book goes to supporting independent bookstores. If you enjoyed this episode, please like, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can also sign up for the Las Musas newsletter to have podcast updates, as well as other Musas news, such as release dates, teasers, spotlights, and more delivered straight to your inbox.